From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we talk with the former head of Wisconsin Energy about the evolution of the utility industry and the evolution of Milwaukee. An essayist considers Kennedy's legacy 50 years after Dallas. Later, a movie special effects whiz on why his field will never completely take over.
While we can visually reproduce an actor, we can't produce his soul. You know, so I'm saying you still are going to need actors to do what they do.
And writer Catherine Murdoch finds unlikely inspiration for a character in her new middle grade novel.
I was in Whole Foods a couple of years ago, and there was a woman in the checkout line, an older woman, and I looked at her and thought, what makes you tick? And that was where Z started, is a woman in the supermarket.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. It's great to have you listening today. It's been 8 years since Dick Abdew stepped down as the chairman of the Wisconsin Energy Corporation, but the Michigan native who started his career as an electrical engineer has not totally distanced himself from his past work. He sits on the board of directors for Menominee Falls-based ZBB Energy, which designs and manufactures energy storage and power control products. And so Abdew has much to say about the state of the utility industry today. We sat down with him in the latest in a series of conversations recorded on the sixth floor of the University Club in downtown Milwaukee. We started by flashing back to where the industry was at the beginning of his career.
When I started in the industry, it was 1963 as a summer student engineer. And the industry was in a period of expansion following World War II. They were still in this period where during World War II, the limiting factor of the military machine in the country was labor and electric energy, getting the electric energy to where it needed to be. And the federal government offered certain incentives to build transmission lines and pipe plants. And so we were still in that. There had been no environmental movement at that point in time. And as we moved forward from there, we began to get the consumer movement. We got the environmental movement. Together, they had a significant impact on the ability to expand electric system in particular. The gas system, it's out of sight, out of mind, and so nobody pays much attention to it. But the electric system, you see the poles and the wires, and there's stuff all over the place, and you got a stack, and everybody wants to know, what's that smoke coming out of the stack and smokestack? And I say, no, it's a chimney, number one. And number two, that's not smoke, it's steam. And nobody will believe you when you tell them that, but it's sort of true. But then as you went through that, there were two oil embargoes. The federal government again offered tax incentives to electric utilities to build more so that we would be more independent. Because at some point prior to the embargoes, oil was so cheap that people were converting coal to oil. Then the embargoes hit, the price of oil went through the roof, and so now the price is up. So then nuclear came in. It's just been a constant. Today, I think the state is in great shape because the new management executed the Power of the Future plan brilliantly, and we have adequate supplies. There is a lot going on in the distribution and transmission system to upgrade it. I think the state of Wisconsin and Milwaukee in particular are in exceptionally good shape.
Given the state of things as you see it today, how concerned should we be either in Wisconsin or nationally or even globally about the security of the grid?
That is always an issue. Even during my tenure, I'd get a visit once or twice a year from the FBI. It's a serious concern. I mean, I don't understand why people don't have something better to do than blow up airplanes or buildings or sabotage electricity lines or gas lines or go to schools with guns. Beyond my comprehension, but there is a segment out there who, for whatever reason, have some sort of illness that compels them to want attention, and that's what they're going to do.
Before we recorded this conversation, you spoke with a group. One of the things that you mentioned was that there are four or five things that stick out in your mind that you wish you had done differently. What are some of the regrets you had from your time with Wisconsin Energy?
probably the largest was the failed merger with Northern States Power Company. At the time, I was the youngest chief executive officer in the whole utility industry, and we had gone through a somewhat unpopular revitalization task force, we called it, and the whole team were young, arrogant, bright individuals, and we had a lot of fun, but we were naive in some respects. And when I look back on that, we all looked at it technically, the benefits to the state of Wisconsin and Wisconsin Electric Power Company and its customers and shareholders from that deal were so immense that we could even commit to $500 million guaranteed reduction in electric rates across the systems. We viewed it, we said basically that the benefits of that are so great, no regulator could turn it down because their job is to balance the interest of the shareholders and customers. It's phenomenal. We did not look at it as a political ploy. And the opposition beat our pants off, and they managed to kill that deal, even though it was the best thing for the state of Wisconsin at the time. So looking back on it, I said there's a couple of things. Had I been 10 years older, I probably wouldn't have had the guts to go do it, so we wouldn't have had the problem. If I had advisors who were 10 years older, who understood the politics of the situation, we would have gone, we would have expanded the horizon. We would have gone, much the way we did with Power of the Future, we would have gone to Madison Gas and Wisconsin Power and Light, Wisconsin Public Service, and said, hey, this is a great deal for the state, and we're prepared to share some of the benefit with you. Madison Gas is a part owner of the Oak Creek units, for example, and so are the municipals. And had we done that, who knows, but there's a good chance that that deal might have actually been consummated.
You are native of the Detroit area.
Yes.
The challenges that are facing Detroit today are pretty well documented. I think they're on everyone's radar. As you look at Milwaukee, and we're sitting on the sixth floor of the University Club recording this, and we can see a nice vista of downtown Milwaukee, do you see Milwaukee on the way up or on the way down?
It's a good question. I think there are vast differences between Milwaukee and Detroit on the governmental side. And Milwaukee is solvent. We are still rated with a very high credit rating. That's very positive. Milwaukee has done a marvelous job of transforming its economy from a bunch of metal benders and manufacturing to more of a high-tech financial services industry. Very positive. We have more people living downtown Milwaukee who are bright young people and retirees. I witnessed the two buildings next door, which is very positive. On the downside, we still struggle with certain segments of the city in terms of education, in terms of services, in terms of crime, in terms of opportunity, to the point where I read a statistic that said there are more people that commute around the city than to the city to go to work. And that's troubling because you need the employment in town. Milwaukee is the guts of the southeastern Wisconsin. And I tell my friends who still live in Mequon, you know, where do you go when you want to have a good meal? Well, they come downtown. They go into the Third Ward. They go down into Bayview. They come down in this neighborhood. Where do you go if you want to go to the play? Well, we come downtown. And you want to the symphony? Well, we come downtown. And we still have all these wonderful things. I believe that on balance, I would say we're holding our own or moving up.
You mentioned the transformation of Milwaukee's economy from a place that bends metal to a place that is more high tech and somewhat more service based, and not everybody has come along on that ride.
And I for one continue to believe, I admire and applaud those individuals who have made the transition into the more service high tech industries, but I still believe that the United States, if we are going to retain our role in the world, and if Wisconsin and Milwaukee in particular are going to regain its stature as one of the great cities in Wisconsin, we're going to have to make stuff. We cannot continue to farm out and have everything that's made be made overseas someplace. It's a very difficult situation and very complex. And let me just give you an example. When we bought Wisconsin Gas, Wycor, we ended up buying the seventh largest pump company in the world. And I remember on my tour of the manufacturing facilities, I went to a plant out in Southern California. It was in a sort of a dilapidated building, and I stopped in this one particular location where there were seven gentlemen making these parts on this big lathe. And on the lathe embossed in the, across it were property of the Canadian War Department, 1934. And I said to these guys, where'd you get this thing? And they said, oh, thank you, Mr. Abdu. Yeah. When you bought the company in Arkansas, the pump company, we got to pick the new equipment. And so we went to Arkansas. This was better than the lathe we had. So I'm thinking, my God, we got seven guys working on this piece of junk from 1934, turning out parts. So then I go to China, where we also manufacture parts. They got one guy with a little CAD-CAM thing. He's designing it, building it. The parts are of higher quality. There's one person. And I said to myself, shame on you. If you gave your Americans the same training and technology to manufacture the parts, they'll beat the pants off that plant over in China. But we don't do it. And the reason we don't do it is because in this country, the way the accounting world rules work, capital has to be depreciated, and there is a life, and everything is based on sort of 30 years because it's old stuff. If, in fact, you change the depreciation laws and companies could invest in the training for their workforce and the new equipment, we could build anything as well, if not better, than anywhere in the world. But we don't do it. We tend to be adverse to capital formation because of technological innovation that'll render the capital obsolete. And then there's no remedy. What do you do?
In terms of the future for energy production, there's some people that point to the potential for nuclear power, a la the way France is using it, for example. I interviewed the environmental activist Bill McKibben some time ago, and he made the point that Germany, which isn't necessarily a sunny and warm place, generates a massive amount of solar power. And he asked the question of why a country with places like Arizona and Nevada and California hasn't been able to capitalize on the sun in the same way. What is the future? Why are nuclear and solar, for that matter, not a bigger part of the portfolio in this country?
Let me address nuclear first. I personally believe nuclear is the safest, cleanest, cheapest way to produce electricity, technically speaking. However, when you look at the regulatory burden and some of the mistakes that were made in the past with every plant being designed different and some of the requirements that were not imposed on the plant owners, we got ourselves in a fix where there is a certain paranoia among the public about nuclear plant. And it's interesting to me that a nuclear power plant uses uranium enriched to about 6%. It doesn't blow up. Not to say it's not dangerous if you're exposed to it, but if you brought a nuclear submarine, the Navy brought one in and parked it right over there in the port, you'd have people flocking over there to take a tour. The fuel on that reactor is enriched to 90%. It's weapons-grade fuel because it's such a small space they have to put it, they enrich it more. That doesn't seem to bother people, but if you got one, it does. So I don't have a lot of hope for nuclear renaissance. With respect to the wind and solar, and I'll admit I'm biased, an investor and a director of ZBB Energy Corp, which makes storage devices and power electronics, which solar without storage is not very good, but with storage is very cost effective. It's been one of those things where you've got the grid is controlled by utility companies who transport their own stuff across there. And for example, if you were to had a farm up north and you put a windmill up there or a solar collector and said, but my house is in Milwaukee. So I call up Wisconsin Electric and see if they'll just ship my power from my windmill down to my house in Milwaukee. They're going to tell you to get lost. I shouldn't speak for them, but my sense is that you would not get a warm reception, and in part because the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin would have to approve a tariff that would allow them to transport your power down to your house. And that is not the way the system was designed, and it's certainly not the way that there would be an argument that other customers are subsidizing you because, you know, you're using the system and not paying the full freight. California just passed such a rule. But a kilowatt hour in California is like 20 cents. So there's a lot going on, and I think if you stood back, it's the same old thing with capital equipment. If you stood back and said, we're going to start over on a piece of paper, and we're going to design a system that uses more solar, more wind, that allows you to put your windmill up in Grafton and transport the power down to Milwaukee, you could do it. It would be cost effective. The system wasn't designed for that. The regulations aren't designed for that. I think we're fortunate in Wisconsin that there is a lot of wind and solar that is built and is operating. It's not cost effective unless there's some sort of storage. I mean, you can't depend on it, so it becomes sort of redundant. But I'm a big believer in renewables. I think that eventually we'll get there.
Would you like to see windmills offshore?
Oh, it doesn't bother me if there were windmills over there. Now, you know, as long as they put them out in front of somebody else's window, it's better. But no. But I mean, I look out my window and I see the Oak Creek Power Plant down there. I think those are nice sites. The point is, you don't have to put them right out on the lake shore to do it if you have a grid that's capable of transporting the power. Now, the farmers might say, well, why put it in my backyard? You don't want it in your backyard. Yeah, it's probably like a transmission tower. Some of us think of those as being, artistic structures, and others think they're ugly. And I guess it depends on who you are and if you recognize the value that the thing provides.
Dick Abdu, it has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you. It's been my pleasure indeed. And I don't know what I did to deserve this wonderful opportunity, but it's certainly been a pleasure.
Dick Abdu was the chairman and CEO of the Wisconsin Energy Corporation from 1991 to 2004. Today, he has a consulting firm and is on the board of directors of Menominee Falls-based ZBB Energy and Ohio-based AK Steel. Our conversation was recorded on the sixth floor of the University Club in downtown Milwaukee. We'll take a quick break now and then some thoughts on today's 50th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Where were you 50 years ago today? It is a question that many people around the world are asking themselves. It was a half century ago on this day that the last assassination of a U.S. president took place, when Lee Harvey Oswald shot and killed President Kennedy in Dallas, Texas. There have been several attempts since on the lives of Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan, but for all the political turmoil of those 50 years, no other presidents have died in office. JFK's 1960 defeat of Nixon ushered in a youthful, forward-thinking era in American politics, and his assassination sent the country into mourning and then itself ushered in the most turbulent part of the 60s. Lake Effect contributor Art Sear offers his take on Kennedy's legacy.
Shortly after the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas on November 22, 1963, CBS commentator Eric Severide noted the principal legacy of the murdered leader might well be an attitude— a contagious spirit that all things are possible if only we have the vision and will. In fact, JFK had important tangible accomplishments, as well as failures, during his brief tenure in office. Nonetheless, Severide was remarkably perceptive in emphasizing the emotional impacts of this president on the population. His shocking, grotesque murder continues to reverberate in our collective lives and culture, even after a half century. The administration's disastrous, failed invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs dogged President Kennedy from the start and provided Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev with strong incentive to deploy offensive missiles on the island. Intense U.S. efforts to kill Fidel Castro, directly pressed by Attorney General Robert Kennedy, spurred Moscow. This led to the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962. In recent years, meetings between surviving officials from both sides in the confrontation have revealed that nuclear war was even closer than realized at that tense time. The president, a combat veteran of World War II, resisted powerful pressure to attack Cuba and was highly imaginative. He and his advisors were able to get the missiles out of Cuba through a blockade, combined with a secret Cuba-Turkey missile trade. Kennedy's outlook contrasts markedly with the administration of President George W. Bush regarding Iraq. In the aftermath of the missile crisis, Kennedy and Khrushchev achieved a treaty banning nuclear tests in the atmosphere, a major breakthrough. The U.S. Senate ratified the treaty with a bipartisan vote of 80-19. JFK had other success with Congress, including international trade legislation authority, key to the successful 1967 Kennedy-Round trade agreement. Two domestic issues always on the front burner were civil rights and organized crime, the former reflecting growing popular pressures, the latter the focus of driven RFK. JFK was careful on race relations, addressing the subject decisively only when pressed to do so by a massive public march on Washington. RFK was relentless in pursuit of the mafia, while simultaneously gangsters were recruited for the efforts to kill Castro. Dallas ended both these efforts. Regarding organized crime, a decade passed before the Nixon administration returned to prosecution, notably with the racketeer-influenced and corrupt organizations, so-called RICO legislation. People around Robert Kennedy were puzzled by his marked disinterest in possible conspiracy in the assassination. In hindsight, RFK no doubt avoided that dark, tangled path because he might come face to face with himself. Senator John Kennedy's book, Profiles in Courage, about U.S. senators who put principle above political expediency, received the Pulitzer Prize. While critics cracked President Kennedy should show less profile and more courage, he actually demonstrated considerable personal strength. Professor Herbert Parmet has documented exceptionally serious health problems that plagued JFK from birth. Despite this, he managed to enlist in the U.S. Navy in World War II, then volunteered for hazardous PT boat duty. Severide's observation applies perhaps most tangibly to the American space program. President Kennedy early on made a dramatic public commitment to carry out a successful manned moon landing, including safe return to Earth. A number of technological innovations resulted from the mammoth space effort, including extreme miniaturization of electronics. Every time you turn on a computer or a cell phone, you're saying hello to JFK.
Lake Effect essayist Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business and director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He's also an occasional Lake Effect contributor on foreign policy issues. Oscar winner, special effects whiz, and Kenosha native Jim Rigel talks about making the Lord of the Rings trilogy and more when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect, I'm Mitch Tyke. In the last 30 years, moviegoers have come to expect more and more sophisticated special effects thanks to advances in computer graphics. And when it's done well, it's seamless with the rest of the action that takes place. And Jim Rigel has done it well. The Kenosha native graduated from UWM in 1977 with a degree in painting and drawing. He found himself in graduate school in Southern California at a time when computers were just being employed to create movie special effects. In the three decades since, Rigel has risen to the top of the profession, creating special effects for movies such as the Lord of the Rings trilogy, The Last of the Mohicans, and Ghost. Back in Milwaukee to be honored by his alma mater, Rigel talked with Lake Effect's Bonnie North about how much of the special effects vision in movies is his own versus that of the director.
It's very collaborative. I'm probably employee one or two after the director because we get started very early in planning the effects for the movie. We'll have a production designer that will sort of influence the overall look. But when it comes to creatures, you know, we'll have a lot of design say in it. Obviously, the director has top say. Gollum is a good example of a design process. So when we were designing it, the creature shop built a life-size maquette or a model of Gollum. And when you looked at it, sort of looked like our typical alien with the big eyes and the elongated face. And so we built that and we put it into the computer and we started animating it. And every time we'd animate it, because we had Andy Serkis also sort of playing the voice of Gollum, but every time we'd animate this other creature, it didn't look quite right. It didn't look real. And no matter how much we tried to put facial features in it, it just never got there. And so, you know, and we'd be looking at Andy Serkis going, well, he looks fantastic. I mean, that's what he looks like Gollum should be, right? So we ended up thinking, well, let's scan Andy Serkis's face and stick it onto Gollum, you know, or put parts of it like mouth features and eye features, and we'll stitch some of that into the original creature. So we did that, and we got it all in there, you know, and then we could see where Andy would make his sort of features with his mouth. We could mimic that with Gollum, and we were getting, you know, close to what we wanted. And it was funny because we brought Andy Serkis in there at one point, and we said, we want to show you what we're doing, you know, and how we're going to accomplish this. And we brought him in, and he saw the Gollum, and he goes, oh, my God. And we said, what? What's are you okay? And he says, that looks just like my dad. Because, we sort of featured him enough, and he was sort of this bald guy, and I don't know what his dad looks like, but it was hilarious. So yeah, I mean, so we're always sort of giving and taking with the director, and you know, obviously getting his approval.
Well, how do you begin to work on an effect? Does it depend on? I mean, I guess what I'm asking, does it come sort of full blown into your head, like out of the head of Zeus kind of thing, or are you doing it bit by bit as the process unfolds?
It's a little bit by bit. I mean, for instance, you know, it's sort of hilarious because we're sort of the bad stepchild of filmmaking. I mean, we're probably 90% of a film, but they tend to pretend that we're 5% of the film because they don't want to pay for what they want, you know. So when I first come into a film, and this happens on every film, they'll say, "Well, you know, we're doing this movie, but we're not going to have a lot of visual effects. We're going to shoot it all practically." And I go, "Great!" I said, "The more you can shoot practically, the better." It's like, "Yeah, we don't probably a couple shots here and there." So like that happened on the current movie Godzilla that I'm working on. I'm thinking, "Wait a minute, Godzilla is a 600-foot creature."
It's like, going to be a few effects in there.
You might need me at a time. So anyway, you know, I let him go down that road. You know, and then when you start getting into the reality of shooting. Which I don't know, it's like $250,000 a day or something like that. You know, they'll say, okay, we can't build a giant 60-foot building that's going to collapse on people. You know, you're going to have to do that visual effect. So what ends up is we end up putting giant green screens everywhere, a couple things in the foreground that people can run around on, and everything else becomes a green screen. So it changes over very quickly. So you don't really plan it, but you always have to be at the ready to make the suggestion for it, you know. So you're always saying, okay, you can't do that. Well, we'll do this up to here. You build this. So it is very collaborative, you know, and you're going back and forth, you know. It's like, well, could you build a little more? And
it almost sounds like you're not getting enough credit for what's happening in a film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people who do what you do, that the director gets the credit, the actors get the credit, but then there's the 90% that you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and again, there's me, and then there's the 400 people that sort of work under me, you know, that are the real guys that are creating the monsters. You know, I'm basically telling them what to do at this point, and they're actually sitting there on the computer and building
coding it all.
And coding it all, yeah. So, yeah, there's a whole army that don't get a lot of credits. And there's a sort of a I don't know. It's sort of a catch-22 at this point, but there's been a lot of big visual effects companies that have gone out of business recently. Rhythm and Hues was a big company which won the Oscar for Life of Pi. And the next day after they won the Oscar, they went out of business. You know, so there's a lot of that happening, particularly in the U.S. because you know, there's a lot of subsidies going on in countries like Canada. So Godzilla, we shot all in Canada. Had to go up there for the tax subsidy, which is quite large. It's like 40%. Or you're going to the UK or, you know, India or some other crazy countries to take advantage. And actually other states too, like Louisiana has a great tax incentive. So Los Angeles is sort of hurting now. It's almost like a ghost town in terms of filmmaking. hard to believe, but it's sort of true because everybody goes to where the money or the less money is, you know. And so, you know, there's been a lot of backlash from the visual effects community. It's like, you know, to try to unionize. And it's sort of at this point where it should have been done like maybe 10 years ago. So it's sort of hard to do right now because if you start unionizing, then, you know, you can always go to Canada.
I was going to say there's even less work because people are already looking somewhere else.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's this weird thing where everybody knows we're sort of getting screwed, but, you know. It's hard to sort of do anything about it at this point.
Well, where do you think it's going to go?
I don't know. On the other hand, there have been a lot of companies going under, but in my experience in the past 30 years, every company I worked at went under. That was happening 30 years ago, you know. So it's nothing really new. It might be a little more out there in your face because, you know it's a big company like Rhythm & Hughes or what was the other one that went? Digital Domain was sort of a little on the rocks. I don't know. Hopefully what will happen is, California will come to their senses and get a nice tax break.
So as you look back on, the 30 years of work that you've done and the work that you're working on and looking into the future, are there particular effects that you are most proud of? Things that you can kind of point to and say, I did that.
Wow. That's really
I know, asking tough. You for about your favorite child.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's tough to sort of talk about. I mean, obviously, Lord of the Rings was sort of the peak of the whole thing because there was just so many different types. I call it the cornucopia of effects. I mean, we had everything in there. We had creatures. We had, practical explosions. We had miniatures. We had,
everything. Yeah.
Pretty much everything. Yeah.
Worlds.
Yeah. Because normally you'll have a movie and it's like, oh, okay. Like Godzilla. It's like I have Godzilla and I need to destroy places and, and that's roughly it. You have set extensions and things. But that was – every shot was like, oh, okay, now we have these creatures and they're fighting next to a miniature and we have to put the miniature into a real set. So that's what was – I found most exciting is incorporating all those different types of pieces into a shot basically.
And 800 people or so that were working on this for you, right?
Well, yeah, directly and indirectly under me. I mean, in terms of, I did some second unit where I was directing 100 extras and then our crew was 400 or 500 people and then the model department was probably 200 to 300 people. So after the Lord of the Rings was all said and done, I found out that over the course of all three movies, there was 25,000 people that worked on the movie. And they said at the premiere, which was held in Wellington, they had a red carpet that went on what's the street, Wisconsin Avenue. It probably went from the lake to, where we are now, this giant red carpet. And they said there was 100,000 people there to see the thing. And I thought, well, that's not a lot. That's like the people that worked on it and their families,
Exactly.
So
when you're working with that number of people and, with that kind of scope, mm-hmm. how do you manage to keep the vision of the director and yourself and the mm-hmm. director of photography? How do you manage to make sure everybody's kind of hewing to what's expected?
Yeah, I mean, it's the pyramid, trickle-down effect. So at each department, like in the miniature department, we had a great head of the miniatures. And so I would have meetings with him and the DP and Peter Jackson. And so there was a relatively small group of people that sort of decided the way the effect was going to go. And we'd say, okay, let's make this a miniature and let's do this practical and this. So the miniature department would talk to his people and then that would sort of trickle down. And he was a sort of craftsman in his own right. And the other thing about it is I always call that time working on The Lord of the Rings as sort of the perfect storm. It seemed like all the exact right people were there. And they came from around the world too. It wasn't just New Zealanders. And they all sort of coalesced to work on that movie. And they really poured their heart into it. And to me, you still see that on the screen to this day. Normally, as you do one film at a time, people will show up. The DP and other guys will be there for a month or two and then sort of go away and you never see them again. You're on to your next movie. But it was this whole group of people that really wanted to be there and really loved what they were doing and, died just to be there, right? And I think that really showed, their love of making this film.
Well, as you look forward in your craft, what do you see as some of the new technologies coming up?
Well, there's this thing at the Academy called Cinema 2.0, and which my wife is involved in, and it's sort of exploring where filmmaking is going to go in general. You know, for instance, Avatar and Life of Pi, right? So it's sort of the ones they've been talking about where the DP won the Academy Award for cinematography. But probably 80% of the film was all computer graphics. No DP. I mean, he sort of set the tone, but when the it gets in the computer graphic world, it's all those computer graphic artists creating that. You know, it's starting to take a look at, like, when you do digital creatures, we're actually doing digital wardrobe, we're doing digital hair, we're doing digital makeup, we're doing digital lighting, we're doing digital cinematography.
Almost digital acting.
To some degree. I don't want to go that far because that's a whole other interesting concept. But it's getting very gray as to who's doing what at this point, you know. The digital acting, while we can visually reproduce an actor, we can't produce his soul, you know. So I'm saying you still are going to need actors to do what they do. And that's like when you see Andy Serkis, I couldn't have 10 animators do what Andy Serkis did. In fact, it was interesting when we were animating Gollum. The first time before we sort of said, let's just copy Andy Serkis because he's great, we had animators doing scenes. And there's one scene where Gollum's sort of looking and talking, and then he goes over a rock and does something else. So we started looking at the dailies, and I saw Gollum, and I said, that's weird. That looks like Linda, one of the animators. You know, it was Gollum. I said, that looks like Linda. And they said, oh, that's interesting because Linda did that shot. And then the next shot, I said, that looks like Hiroki. Oh, Hiroki did that shot. And I'm like, okay, something's going on here. And so you go back to their workstations, and the way that they're animating Gollum is they're looking at a mirror. They're doing the facial expressions that Gollum would do, but it's their expressions. And it would completely come through as them. So you really need that actor to get his what I call his soul and his expressions out. We can make him look different or make him look, you know, like a real human being, but you can't copy his emotions.
So you need that 20%.
Definitely need that, yeah. We've been trying to get an Academy Award for Andy for a decade now because it's Andy. It's not the animators doing that. It's Andy's performance. And yet they're not allowed to get an award at that point because they're digital. You know, so we're trying to break all those different barriers down and say, well, it was him. And we presented to the Academy as here's Andy and here's Gollum side by side doing the same thing, you know.
So interesting times. I mean, very much a time of transition.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, it's trying to, again, break down the old barriers of what we think filmmaking is, and it's going to happen. It's just, you know.
Well, like anything, it takes time to catch
exactly,
up.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you just finished Godzilla?
I'm still working on
it.
So I'm doing the post now. We're making that creature.
Lovely. And then, so what's next after that? Do you know?
I don't know. Yeah, you start realizing you need to find your next job and you start looking. So.
Okay. Well, good luck.
Yeah, thank you.
With that. And it has been such a pleasure.
Oh, thank you.
Having you in the studio. And welcome back to your alma mater.
Yeah, it's great.
And I hope that you'll come back and chat with us again.
We will.
Kenosha native, UWM graduate, and multiple Oscar winner Jim Rigel was back in Milwaukee to receive the Chancellor's Recognition Award from UW-Milwaukee. Rigel has been supervisor of special effects on numerous movies, most notably the Lord of the Rings trilogy, A Night at the Museum, Air Force One, and Batman Returns. He spoke with Bonnie North. You can hear more of their conversation, including a special effect that didn't work, at WUWM.com/lake effect. A last break, and then writer Catherine Murdoch returns to the fictional Wisconsin town she created for a new novel. We'll hear more when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Catherine Murdoch's Wisconsin-based series of middle-grade novels was supposed to be done by now. The series, which started with the novel Dairy Queen, related the experiences of a high school girl named DJ Schwenk, who played high school football and basketball in the fictional town of Red Bend. But after the trilogy concluded, Murdoch couldn't let the characters disappear. So DJ Schwenk returns in a supporting role in Murdoch's new book, Heaven is Paved with Oreos. The central character in the story is actually the would-be girlfriend of Schwenk's younger brother, Curtis. It brings readers back to central Wisconsin as Sarah Zorn works to figure out her relationship with Curtis and with her grandmother, whom she accompanies on a pilgrimage to Rome. Murnock herself returned to real-life Wisconsin recently, where she spoke with some real-life school students in Heartland, and we tagged along. Nice to see you again.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with what just took place in this library. We're sitting here in the library of the University Lake School, and you've just had this about an hour-long experience with the students here. What do you get out of coming to a school like this and doing a program like this? This is not about selling books, right?
No, it's not about selling books. It's gratifying on a bunch of levels. One, when I was a kid, if I had had the opportunity to meet an author, I would have given my right arm. I remember, I will never forget, that the librarian from our town met Robert Cormier at a librarian book event, and I touched her like the way someone who's met Elvis has, he sat here once. George Washington slept here. So I just remember that excitement of realizing that there are authors and you could be this. So there's lighting up those kids. And then there are the kids who aren't readers, but who you can see are really getting turned on by the process. And, oh, can I read your book? Can I've never read a book by myself. I want to read. And that is where the universe comes together. When you get a kid who's been a reluctant reader and you can see that now they're going to try it and you might open up the world for them.
Is demystification the right word for both cases, the demystification of the author as a person and the demystification of books as an accessible thing?
Wow, demystification. I'm thinking more, okay, this is really heady for me because I think about books as very mystical. So, and the more I get into the writing process, the more abstract it becomes for me. And my son had a teacher in second grade who said, I don't know how kids learn how to read. They just do. It's magical. And that's, I feel like that. I don't know how writing works. It's just magical. So maybe I'm demystifying it for others, but I certainly don't feel it's clear in my own head.
There were a group of, 80 kids in here, and maybe three of them, maybe four of them, maybe five of them asked the question in a different, each of them in a slightly different way, where do you get your ideas? What do you take from that question?
Well, that's the, I think for a lot of people, not just kids, but for adults as well, that there is a mystical belief that stories start with ideas. And I think that's true, but what a lot of people who aren't writers don't realize is that that's just one part of it, that there's a whole bunch of craft that goes into writing in addition to the art. The idea is the art. And if you work at it, the art almost becomes secondary to the craft, that everyone can come up with an idea, but you have to put in a lot of hours. Michelangelo, it took him 4 years to paint the Sistine. Not that I'm Michelangelo, that's not my point. You can have an idea, but ideas come from, and what I try to keep saying is ideas come from a lot of different places. It's not that flash of inspiration and you see the story outlined before you. You have to put in the hours.
In a way, it's a little inconvenient that the first book, that Dairy Queen, actually started with a dream.
Yes and no, because I've actually made it into a slide presentation where I photograph the dream that I had about a girl playing football is one sentence in the Dairy Queen book. And when I do slide presentations, I have a photograph of that page and that one sentence highlighted and the math, and I calculate, do the math equation on how many words are in the book. So the inspiration was like 0.01% of the book. So the idea is a very small part. 99% of it is hard work.
This is like the iconic image of the universe with the little the sign that says, you are here.
Wow, yes. I was thinking more about, there's a myth, and I was in screenwriting for a while, and there's Sylvester Stallone wrote the screenplay for Rocky in 6 weeks. And if you say that to a screenwriter, they come out of their chair, and they're like, that screenplay was shopped for years. It had a whole bunch of people. It's not that you have an idea, and you sit down, and you write, and it's done. It's a much more technical process than that. And in a way, I find that immensely reassuring because it means that you do not have to be you don't wait for the thunderbolt to hit you. Just if you work at it, you don't have to be a genius. You just have to be a hard worker.
You, in the presentation today, talked about the idea of the sequel as being the author's effort to make sure the characters that he or she created are doing all right. You kind of swore that three was it for the Dairy Queen characters, and here is number four. Were you not sure they were okay?
I swore that three was it for DJ. And three is it for DJ. And if you read the Dairy Queen trilogy, she has this amazing character arc over three books. And she's really launched as a, I hate to use the word adult because that has all this baggage, but she's launched as a functional human being at the end of the book. But there were other characters, particularly her little brother, who I was worried about. And the reason I volunteered to write the sequel is I was worried about DJ's little brother. And so I wrote the sequel to show how he was doing, even though he doesn't have a huge part in the book. He's a very critical part. And he doesn't have a huge part in Heaven is Paved with Oreos, but he's a critical part of the story. And I still want to keep making sure that he's okay, because I really care about that kid, and he just needs to learn how to talk.
Well, and I wonder if there's something to the idea of characters in books for especially the grades that you target as being more than just characters on a literary page to the people that consume them, that they inhabit a larger part of the world for a kid than maybe an adult reader might see.
Oh, I totally agree with that, that even the books that I read now for kids, the good books, the example that I'm bringing up that I mentioned in the session was How to Catch a Bogle. The main character of that book lives with me. She's such a compelling character, and I'm so vested in making sure that she's okay, and I can't wait for the sequel to come out to find out how she's doing. The neat thing about children's literature, of young adult and adult literature, is that no matter what else is happening in the story, you have this arc of the main character grows up. And kids and adults are looking for direction of, you know, how do I do this? How do I live? How do I function as an adult? How do I do this better? And a good story will do that in a way that is not preachy at all and is hopefully not even noticeable. But you get that message across. And I think that's why the characters stay with kids, is because, oh, if I know how Harriet the Spy would handle this situation. I know how Hermione, okay, if I can just be more like Hermione, I can dot, dot, dot.
Well, and I think one of the remarkable things that transpires in Heaven is Paved with Oreos is Sarah, your protagonist, coming to terms with the reality of her grandmother. And it seems like an underrated part of growing up is not just understanding that your parents are flawed, but the people who often really do get a free pass, the grandparents, are real people too.
The relationship that Sarah has with her grandmother is so – it is not the relationship that I had with my grandmother, but it is so meaningful, and it is that recognition that people are fallible, and you have to make your – you have to figure out how to deal with it. You can't just push it aside. Z, her name is Azalea, but everyone calls her Z, in the book, is – she was such a compelling character for me, and I really at times had to work to silence her because she was trying to take over the story. And she actually writes one section of the book, and she writes a letter to Sarah, and it's a quarter of the book. And I checked into a hotel. I was writing, and I really needed to get this book done. And I checked into a hotel, and it was 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm sitting at my computer, and I'm writing the letter, and I'm crying just because the letter meant so much to me. So, wow, I broke out in goosebumps just telling that story. But that she is really, really real to me. She is not based on anyone I know, except I will say, I didn't mention this to the kids. I was in Whole Foods a couple of years ago, and there was a woman in the checkout line, an older woman, and I looked at her and thought, what makes you tick? And that was where Z started, is a woman in the supermarket.
And of course, Whole Foods does not exist in small town Wisconsin.
No.
Well, and along those lines, you have kind of created this alternate rural Wisconsin. Does it at all, when you are in real life rural Wisconsin, give you pause to think of the alternate universe Wisconsin that you have created?
I'm glad that it's an alternate universe. I really went out of my way to make sure that none of the place names are real place names, which is hard in Wisconsin because there are a lot of place names. And for a long time, the town that DJ lived in was called Red Lake. I mean, there isn't a Red Lake, Wisconsin, but there's a Red Lake, Minnesota. So I wanted Wolf Lake, which would be really cool. But there's a Wolf Lake, Wisconsin that has three houses in it, but I'm just, oh, come on, give me Wolf Lake. And there's a Prophetstown, Illinois, but there's not a Prophetstown, Wisconsin. So I got to use Prophetstown, which is such an appropriate name for the town where Z lives. But it is sort of a mythic, it's a mythic universe, and it's intentionally mythic because I want it to be universal enough that a lot of people can identify with it. And I get a lot of communication from people who say Red Bend is just like my town, and they live in Brooklyn. And you're like, well, actually, it's probably not. But it's still, it's good enough for, it's broad enough for everyone to appreciate.
There's a Red Hook in Brooklyn, right? Is that right?
I'd forgotten about that. Yes. There, but I don't think Red Bend and Red Hook have a lot to do with each other.
It is something to be sitting in the middle of a middle school library and knowing that it's still full of books. And one of them, I'm looking over your shoulder, is actually about Henry Kissinger, which is kind of surreal, actually. But there is something, I don't know, as an outsider, that seemed encouraging about a room full of people who were really kind of hanging on every word, talking about books in this era where we often hear that, you know, books' shelf life is limited.
Story is eternal. There is always story. There will always be story. How that story is conveyed is a bit in flux right now. I am immensely prejudiced toward paper books. I'm not a big ebook person, in part because I love the experience of holding it, and I love the experience of knowing how long it is until the end, which is just not the same with an ebook. You don't know how much further you have. And it really is remarkable how much a part of my consciousness that is that you pace yourself from where you are vertically in the book. And I'm reading a book right now, and I'm like, this is really good, but I'm not sure I can do another inch and a half of pages. And if you can get kids reading, that's what it's all about.
And did you hear how interested the kids were in the cover of your of all of your books? I mean, and I don't know that you would have that kind of conversation about an ebook.
No, no, no. There.
Well, Catherine Gilbert Murdoch, thank you so much, as always, and come back and see us again.
Thank you so much. This was wonderful.
Catherine Murdoch's latest middle grade novel, set in the fictional town of Red Bend, Wisconsin, is Heaven is Paved with Oreos. It's a corollary to her Dairy Queen series. We spoke with her in the real-life town of Heartland, Wisconsin, where she was visiting students at the University Lake School. You can find more about the books at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's Friday's edition of the show. We're produced by Stephanie Lecce, Dan Harmon, and Bonnie North, with assistance from Nathan Royster and Eleanor Peterson. I'm Mitch Teich. Have a terrific weekend, and thanks so much for tuning in today. Do join us tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.